Yo, yo, I hope y'all ready to go, cause I'm ready to flow. And blow like a volcano, y'all ain't even ready to know. Got so much excitement and so many good feelings as we're here today to celebrate in Creative HQ of New Zealand. When you come from overseas, the first thing you see is just trees and honeybees, clean mountain springs and endless fields of green. From the jungle valley to the mountain peaks, we listen to Mother Nature and hear loudly she speaks. Got world champion rugby and Lord of the Rings, awesome Manuka honey, and Earth's happiest sheep. It's literally in tomorrow. 21 hours ahead means 3 hours behind. Southern hemisphere, different stars, a whole different sense of time. But then you look closer, and more is perceived. Because like a tree, New Zealand's roots run strong and deep. With a culture not based on commerce, but on kindness, one that values the importance of wisdom, balance, and silence. Kiwis value fairness, compassion, and honesty, witty and reflective with self-effacing modesty. Balancing individual responsibility with deep civic connections. Leaders elected fairly in honest, open elections.
All right, folks. Episode 39, that was some Americans in New Zealand. We'll get to them in the post game. They're in charge of who gets to come to New Zealand and innovate, wouldn't you know? But David, Chris,
man, that's like what, second level, third level colonization at this point, right?
It is, and they're doing it in a very, you know, holistic and namaste way. I'm Matt Leck. I watched that last night, and it's the sort of thing where I ran distance in high school, and you know, when you realize how much longer you have to go, I wasn't good with facing that moment, which is why I didn't run distance for that long. But there's a point in that video where I looked and I'm like, how much time is left? And there's 50 seconds of a minute 36. And I'm like, well, I'm sorry, left reckoners, but you're going to have to be subjected to all that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty rough. And I don't think that's the only little bit of Facebook rapping that we're going to be hearing tonight.
No, I mean, not even by that guy, actually. But but before that, we have some fun stuff, David. We have an interesting austerity, the coalition of austerity, sort of a Justice League type of team that is getting together to basically defend Kyrsten Sinema from naughty protesters that are asking her to maybe do something for people that aren't the National Restaurant Association. And
even worse, NRA.
Yeah, exactly. The NRA you weren't prepared for. I have some amusing forays into this. The first was, well, by one Joe Biden himself, who came out, and this is the Joe Biden we like. You know, I finished Adam Tooze's book, and one of the recent histories that he goes over that I think is worth looking into is, you know, I'm serious about January 6th, but I also think the way Biden handled it was really well, and not hyperventilating about that, and like, we got this, because they did, right? Ultimately, he did. And there are people that were saying, why won't Joe Biden like freak out? And he nailed that. And this is a similar to his response to Kyrsten Sinema. She's been protested a couple times, once outside of a classroom at ASU. I mean, imagine being in that class. I don't think she's probably super responsive to her Rate My Professors, reviews. But here is good old Joe. Base Joe, as people are calling him, more and more people are saying, and here is his response to
Mr. President, you're talking about how you have 48 Democratic votes right now. The other two have been pressured over the weekend by activists. Joe Manchin had people on kayaks show up to his boat to yell at him. Senator Sinema last night was chased into a restroom. Do you think that those tactics are crossing a line?
I don't think they're appropriate tactics, but it happens to everybody. From the only people it doesn't happen to are people who have Secret Service standing around them. So it's a part of the process. Yes.
A lot of people have been trying to attack immigration.
Now, Biden's probably not going to do very well on tacking on immigration there. That protester, I hope it'd be amazing if the Democrats came through and tacked that on. But that's not even really in the conversation as far as I know. But yes, like it happens to everyone. But the more interesting thing is how this TPUSA guy, Danny De Urbina, look at this guy. This is the same people who have been like downplaying January 6th. I think that is a relevant comparison. Like, wow, Biden just dismissed Kyrsten Sinema being harassed and courted into a bathroom this weekend. And I also want to note Sinema's the sort of like, I think, despicable way she's characterizing these things as if there's been a crime committed. Like, she suggested in her statement on her official senator stationery that people were filmed, like, going to the bathroom, which is like, no, that there was filming inside of this restroom that you were being questioned at, but it's not like there was an under the stall sort of.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, right? And that sort of. That is authoritarianism in sort of plain speak. And the last people we should be asking how to protest, I would say, senators of the United States of America.
Senators, the people who are literally as far, like, are you know, when it comes to elected officials, are as far away from the ballot box as you can get, right? Like, because their terms are so long. Like, those are people who you should be able to put maximum pressure on by other means than just, you know, that one time when you get to vote or not vote for them.
I don't even like when AOC does it, even when she's right, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like, because I don't think it's, like, the place. I think she, not to get into that, but, like, she sees herself as a political educator, but I also think, like, you're a congressperson, right?
Yeah.
Like, and that those, there's some conflict between those two things. But so yeah, the we have Danny De Urbina going down here, and we had a whole bunch of people. We had Stephen Crowder, and the way that they defend this is, I think, what I'm more interested in talking about, which is that nobody wants to say we don't want this money spent on you people. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't want to go into what's being spent. Like, Joe Manchin's the only one coming out and saying, like, entitlements and stuff like that. I mean, occasionally you'll get a rabid Republican talking about, like, the socialism of the $3.5 trillion or something like that. But these guys, these Stephen Crowders and Dave Rubens, that's bad business, because you're fundamentally trying to appeal to normal people, working people, who, like, would like to see some spending, frankly. Mm-hmm. So anyway, here's how Crowder attacks it by the classic right-wing thing of demonizing the immigrant.
Right. And she also said, you're my senator.
Right.
Do you understand what that implies?
Yes, that she voted
illegally.
Yeah.
That is not at all the case. Like,
ooh, boy.
I have not voted in plenty of elections, and I still considered that person my senator. And, like, right, like, that doesn't track at all. And this is, this entire next minute 90 of, frankly, like, bigotry is entirely predicated on this dumbass brainwave of a frankly stupid producer who constantly makes dumb assertions like this. Well, I just want to keep playing a little bit more.
Right. And she also said, you're my senator.
Right.
Do you understand what that implies?
Yes. That she voted
illegally.
Yeah.
How did an illegal?
What's your point?
How many times,
just
though?
Saying, like,
you seem surprised.
I seem very surprised.
Oh, okay. Right? How did she get on a plane? Like, what identification did she
get? Yeah.
No, that's racist.
Just accused.
They have identification.
Essay of being racist.
And they were like, go ahead, it's fine.
I don't need to go to the machine. Is it because I'm Latinx?
No. Go ahead. You can go. Go around the ropes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, that's totally good. Yeah. My system still works. Okay.
I'm going to go ask this lady some questions.
I don't have to pay.
Okay, that's probably enough for this.
Yeah,
guys.
That's the assholes.
Yeah, and then we'll just get with one more Dave Rubin here, who doesn't take quite that egregious of a...
And people say, hey, you think we should deport these people? Sorry.
Interesting thing, unfortunately. I think we've crossed what I would say is a very strange and dangerous Rubin.
This is what I like about Dave Rubin, is he's a poet. You think about what this means, a strange and dangerous Rubicon. The Rubicon, of course, if memory serves, the river that Caesar crossed with an army. This is a strange and dangerous Rubicon, of course.
And then finally, this one, I mean, this is just going to be an ongoing thing, unfortunately. I think we've crossed what I would say is a very strange and dangerous Rubicon in America. Kyrsten Sinema, who is the senator from Arizona, we showed the video yesterday of her being harassed in the bathroom. I think it was at Arizona State University, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Well, now she was on a plane where she got harassed again, that at an airport after. So we're going to show you some video. And we've sort of said now it's okay to get up in their face, which, as you guys know, this is exactly what Maxine Waters and many of the Democrats were saying all along. You can get up in their face. She was talking about Republicans, but now it has come home even to her Democrat people. Should we do it?
I like the flourish at the end. It is quite beautiful.
But it's interesting, this sort of interference being run on behalf of the right-wing center. People are like, it didn't bother me when people call them the moderate centers, because I understand what moderate means. But I also think, like, corporatist is maybe even a two inside baseball. Right wing, like, this is the right wing of the Democratic Party, these two. I mean, corporatist is also just as fine, too. But it's been fascinating to me to see this sort of congealment around these two folks.
Oh, I mean, for sure. But it's because they're doing the extension. They're the extension now of the GOP, right? And not that, you know, the Democratic Party represents some kind of radical break from, Republican rule. This is showing where the limits are, within Congress. I don't know. I mean, it's cheap shit, right? Obviously, them getting worked up, the TPUSA folks, Dave Rubin getting worked up about people protesting, protesting politicians. Is ridiculous, especially given, you know, all the things, as much as I'm very much of agreement with you, by the way, that like AOC does like to, you know, sort of make a big scene about a lot of these things, but the kind of stuff that she experiences is nothing. Is much more serious than what like Sinema's facing by somebody following her to a bathroom after after refusing time and time again at this critical moment in the Biden administration, a critical moment in these kind of fights, critical moment in dealing with things like climate change. You know, you're refusing to speak publicly about what you want. You're refusing to speak to your constituents. I'm sorry, somebody following you into a bathroom in a public space it's not that extreme.
Yeah. And we have Bernie hitting Manchin about Manchin saying, you know, I disagree with Bernie that I don't want an entitlement society, which is just, I mean, frankly, really infuriating, knowing everything we know about Joe Manchin, particularly like his daughter and the EpiPen X2 scandal, where as a person who lied about having a business degree, she conspired with, was it Pfizer or one of the other medical giants, agree to kill a competing product, EpiPen, and then use that market power to not only drive up the price of a single EpiPen, but force you to buy two of them in bulk, and just to gouge, again, like public and school districts and stuff like
by
that.
The way, I just want to add this because I always have to, was exposed, asking the medical team if they could come up with a scientific reason for having to package the pens together, right? Because they had none other than the fact that they knew they'd make more money by doing that.
Yeah, we have a meeting tomorrow. Can you come up with a medical rationale in the meantime? Thanks. Talk to you Insane. Later. And that's the person who's given us lectures about entitlement.
No, I mean, I'm just saying, like, this is the thing about the reconciliation bill, is it puts us in a weird situation because, like, I think it's woefully inadequate, like, in the full 3.5 trillion version, right?
And it's going to be pared down. Beyond that, probably.
But I think sometimes treating Sinema and Manchin as if they're doing this for, like, ideological reasons in the kind of, like, conception of like left versus right, how most Americans think about it, is a huge mistake. I mean, this is just truly an example of corporate rule over politicians. The reason that they're doing this is not because Manchin like truly believes in these kind of like homespun values of, you know, thrift and saving. It's because he has a shitload of people who have his ear who are telling him, you need to stop this bill from going through.
Yeah.
Primarily because, you know, people are afraid this will be used as a justification to increase things like corporate taxes, right? I mean, there's a whole host of things that in the reconciliation bill that frighten corporate America, which is why they've sent out their foot soldiers in a really apparent in public way to fight against it. I don't know. It's just like it's nothing that's like truly like, you know, there's no argument to be had with Sinema and Manchin on this unless you can show them that we have more power than the people who are getting them to do what they're doing.
Yeah, and I think that's ultimately what is, I think, a little bit disappointing on my, like, Biden seems to have an understanding. He's still saying, like, I think we'll get a bill done, right? Which mm-hmm. means that they're going to be able to pare some shit off of it. And so even then, you know, I don't know. It's a good thing, but like you said, I think the most clarifying thing is this, that you see this is a party corrupt by austerity to do even like a Build Back Better in a half serious way. Like this is basically Build mm-hmm. Back to the bare minimum. Right. And it, yeah, like it put Manchin Sinema, like they can't elaborate a defense of this that has any relation to any kind of rationality, like the Constitution.
Yeah.
And Sinema's frankly just lying about, she's trying to mislead, saying that she's actually supporting things she's not supporting, because she can't, there's nothing to say, right? Mm-hmm. This is the part where this is all bullshit. Mm-hmm. And they have the power and they're just not going to do it. And it's useful, I guess, to draw that parallel. But I mean, it is disappointing because like, or I think the message has to be, or the lesson from this is how corrupt the party is. And Biden, if he can't get like basic shit done, I think the next thing to note is that there's no urgency in leadership to deal with this as a problem.
Yes.
Right? Like, where have we seen any kind of, like, again, like, Trump is actually a useful precursor here, because what would he have done if any pipsqueak senator was standing in the way like this? It's clear. Like, so all mm-hmm. this stuff about decorum is out the window now.
I mean, for sure, but it's like even absolutely like Trump would be hitting in certain ways. But I think it's more notable when you look at Trump, look at the things that he was actually successful at doing as president were very different from the things that he talked about or campaigned on. Right. It was like government on autopilot. It was, you know, policies that were helping out the super rich in this country much more than, you know, fundamentally changing, you know, any kind of dynamic in the way that, you know, Trump's like vision of America represented. It was just kind of like corporate autopilot. Politics from Trump with like insane Trumpian theater on top of it. And I think that that's like the real kind of lesson that you're seeing right in front of you with Manchin and Sinema is like, it's a little bit less about like what they personally believe about things and much more. I mean, the most notable thing about Manchin, even like more so than all of the campaign contributions that he gets, which are, you know, enormous, and they point to a certain group of people, it's the amount of money that Manchin makes off of a fossil fuel dividends, right? Like Manchin is just so personally invested in maintaining this system that anything that is even a slight threat to it, he's going to use his power to prevent it from happening, right? And like that's the end of
but
the game.
But David, he's got a blind trust. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, he's got a blind trust, which means, I mean, you'd have to be really, really blind to not realize that anything that's doing something about regulating fossil fuel companies or combating climate change is probably not in the interest of somebody who's heavily invested in fossil fuel companies.
Yeah, exactly. Should we let Kaylin or let's do a little plug first, I think. Recent conversation, Sam Hoadley-Brill on critical race theory. I think we're going to hear more and more of that about it, folks. I think, and he's a really smart guy on the topic. So yeah, check it out. I don't really have much else to say about that. I do post some pictures of James Lindsay looking at a piece of paper and scrutinizing it, and also waving a sword around. So that is also available in video form. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access.
We got sword vids. We talked about how James Lindsay and all those folks really don't understand
Marxism. Sam and I actually have a fun conversation sort of breaking down why postmodernists and Marxists didn't really get along. We also break down why a lot of Marxists didn't get along with the Frankfurt School. So there's some nutritious stuff in there too, other than just dunking on the right wing.
Some stuff Mark Levin might be interested in maybe listening to.
I mean, yeah, we'll send a copy to Mark. But yeah, you can get that at patreon.com/leftreckoning. And this weekend, Matt and I will be releasing what we do every first week of the month, which will be a think tank. We're already getting some really exciting questions and topics. So to be able to participate in that, join us at patreon.com/leftreckoning. And if you are a patron, please send us some questions and topics too, because we're always happy to hear from you. Mm-hmm. But we'll be back in just a couple moments with Kale. All right. Kale Brooks from Jackman.
All right, here he is. Be right.
Back. All right. Well, welcome back, everybody. I'm really excited to be joined today by our good friend Kale Brooks from Jackman. How are you doing, brother?
Good. Good to be back. Good to see you both. It's been a while.
Yeah.
It has been.
How many people have had two rounds on Left Reckoning?
Not many. I was just thinking it was baby Left Reckoning when you made your first appearance.
Yeah.
We've had Ben Burgess on a few times for sure. I'd have to look at the schedule. But yeah, no, we're really happy to have you back. Kale's a fun guy because he's able to talk about a lot of different subjects. And he, I think, somewhat like me, but you might be... I don't know, not more dour, but Kale is a little bit more clear eyed about some of the kind of like excesses of the left. So I'm really excited to be talking to him about this today. I think to sort of talk about what we're trying to get at, we're talking about the relationship between like the left, specifically left parties and the working class. And that's a big subject and there's a lot of history there. But I think we're going to try to pull back some things so that we can at least have a better theoretical understanding of like what's happened. And maybe if we get there, touch on some ways that maybe we can get out. But maybe to sort of put as like a news peg for folks who aren't familiar, you know, Germany, they just had their elections. And one of the more disappointing results was what happened with Die Linke, right? Which is essentially the party of the left. It broke from the SPD to sort of carve out a more like radical socialist movement. And it had some traditions with working class and socialist voters in East Germany. But what we've seen, at least with this most recent wave of elections, was that they really were thoroughly rejected by the working class and by voters in general, but specifically by the working class. And one thing that people have been sort of pointing to and noting is that, you know, there's a kind of irony where in Berlin, you have this vote to expropriate landlords, but yet the party that is actually saying that they would enforce that policy and do the thing that all these people want did not, you know, walk away with the victory here. And I don't know, maybe it's, I don't want to front load this too much, but like, I would just know something like if I lived in Spain or Germany, I would certainly be very, very happy to be able to vote for like a Podemos or Die Linke compared to what we have in the United States. You know, the options we have here are certainly terrible, but I really wouldn't feel closer to that. I wouldn't feel that we were any closer to building socialism than we are in the United States because fundamentally those parties we've seen have had a lack of connection between the parties and the working class. Mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe we can just sort of talk about like where working class voters have gone after leaving the traditional working class parties or after the parties left them, whatever, you know, phrasing you prefer.
Well, even before that, I mean, yeah, just your comment that if you were in Spain or if you were in Germany, you would want to vote for these parties. People who are like you that are in Spain and in Germany do vote for these parties. Yeah. That like, this is in fact, kind of the problem that it's like these parties, these left, like explicitly left parties end up attracting and getting primarily the votes of more kind of urban professionals, not necessarily affluent, although, you know, sometimes it can be a little bit more affluent, but, it's mostly people that have degrees that, entered into the labor market after 08, expecting to be able to use that degree and have maybe some kind of professional career, and realize that most of the economy in the advanced industrialized world is now service sector. And so there really weren't that many jobs for these people. And so this is where you get the notion of downwardly mobile, middle class, professional youth. And those are the people who vote for these parties. And a lot of them, of course, do hold good left and universal and egalitarian principles. It's not to denigrate these people, that it's to their credit that in the face of massive crises around the world and in Europe, and in the, this is obviously not just a European phenomenon, but we just don't have a left party in the way that a lot of these countries do. The closest comparison would be like people joining the DSA or something, or voting for Bernie Sanders, but that's a little bit more complicated. But the point being is that these people have like the right moral principles in the face of economic and political and social crises. There's two other problems. It's one that because they're middle class, their material interest in these politics tends to be a little bit more thin. And beyond that, it's just a numbers game that these people, in fact, only make up a small sliver of the population. And so it ends up kind of highlighting the real issue, which is what you're talking about, which is where are the working class voters in the left parties? Why is it that it's only morally driven, not exclusively morally driven, but primarily morally driven, downwardly mobile middle class people that end up entering into these left parties? And not only staff and occupy kind of the, it's part of the challenge here is also explaining how an actual party works, because in the US we don't have real parties, but you can become a member of a party if we were in Spain or in Britain or in Germany. And so the actual membership of the party, the people who end up becoming active, you could call activists, in like their actual political commitments to the party, again, it ends up being this population and not working people. We can get to like why that happened and then, where are the working people?
No, I mean, I also just think it's worth noting too, that, the parties specifically in Europe, like they did have at least some tradition of working class parties, right? They weren't necessarily perfect. But I don't know, just very much different histories, even with like electoral democracy than we have in the United States when it comes to party formation, right? They're saying Die Linke has like, sort of broke out of the more traditional left, working class left in Germany. Podemos was a kind of supposed to be a new formation as well, right? Because I mean, it's just one of those things when we're talking about the new parties, we have to be a little bit careful, especially for people who aren't familiar with the politics of those countries. Cause it's different from like Labour Party in the UK, right? Where you have like the traditional working class party. And then the party sort of moves in certain directions and the working class people stop voting for them in large scales versus these other kind of gambits that like, we are going to create the new formation that was going to attract working class voters.
Well, it's interesting because, and again, I'm going to sweep over this very quickly, but like you're saying, over 100 years ago, you get in the late 19th century, you get the rise of social democratic and labor parties, parties that are oriented towards mobilizing and representing working class people. And they do in fact rise and they do become massive parties. The German SPD, the Social Democratic Party, becomes the biggest party in Europe at the time, pre-World War I. And it genuinely is rooted in working class people's lives. That does not mean that every single person in the party is a working class person. The left has always had middle class people. But the party was seen as the actual representative of working people that had to tumultuously push its way into parliament, that it was part of the challenge for the Europeans was actually gaining political democracy. The actual right to vote came alongside the rise of working class and social democratic parties. Whereas in the US that didn't happen. And we also didn't get a Labour Party, but regardless, it's so these parties did in fact hold many working class people their electoral votes, and then after World War One, again I'm in broad brushstrokes, you do get the rise of communist parties, and communist parties do successfully take up a good chunk of working class voters that they do successfully migrate from one to the other. And then later you get like Euro communist parties by the 70s. And it's not worth going into all these details, but what's worth noting is that this is really the person to turn to for a lot of what I'm about to say is Peter Mayer. It was a Irish political scientist that passed away about 10 years ago. But as right before he died, he was working on a ton of research, and it came out in this book called Ruling the Void, which is basically showing that across the spectrum, across Europe, and I mean, he incorporates the US in somewhat, it's not, you know, it's mostly focused on the US, but the point was that since the 70s, especially accelerating in the 90s, you get this massive drop off of political participation across the board. And primarily that's in working class people, partially just because working class people are the majority in a society. But the thing is, so you get this drop off in left parties, in parties that typically would represent the working class, even those that, continue to have a party like the SPD already before this decline has already, significantly transformed its political agenda. By the 60s, it's a very different party than it was in, 1913. But that being said, you get this massive drop off of political membership participation. Who's like the actual voter turnout? How many people are actually showing up both for elections and for referendums? And we see that too in the U.S. Although, again, obviously the institutions are different. We have the Democrats and Republicans, but beginning around the same period, you do see the same kind of decline in voter participation. Although in the U.S., arguably that decline starts much earlier, actually. I'm posing all this to say, like, there's nothing that says, like, by law, new parties coming in can't pick up working class people. The fact that there are new left parties that emerge in the last 20 years, it's not, just the rule that, a new party that is aimed at the working class can't successfully pick them up because they're too attached to a different party. Because again, the communist parties during the 20th century show us that that's not true. I think there's other factors, and it just deals with more. The point is more that working class people have been so thoroughly demobilized and so depoliticized, beginning again in the period that Peter Mayer is talking about. Really, you see these drop offs beginning in the 70s, and there's reasons for why that is, but that ends up becoming, I think, the larger determining factor, the fact that membership and voting both to the left and the right ends up declining.
What variables do you use to explain that? Like, or would you highlight to explain that?
So I think, the first thing worth saying is just that, political democracy has been a fairly tumultuous thing historically. I mean, we don't actually have that much history of like stable eras of like party systems, because for the most part, we have a period of party systems prior to the rise of the working class. So prior to like the mid to late 19th century, and the party system then was largely just kind of a formality. It was a coronation of the elites, because if the one section of the elites are more powerful than another section of the elites, that's already going to be borne out, structurally. And so it's more just kind of a formality of, well, we're going to get my cousin needs a job and I'm going to put him in the state. But with the rise of the working class, and you do get these new political configurations where, again, the U.S. is different, unfortunately, because of the fact that our party system ends up being such that working people are divided among both parties. And so even though the Democrats and Republicans represent different sections of the elite, different sections of capital, those that are maybe more labor intensive or more capital intensive or more internationally focused or more domestically focused or more in manufacturing or something, you get these different divisions. Historically, the parties are representing those interests and not working people, but the working people are strung along in that system. Whereas in the European case, the conservative and the liberal parties don't represent working people, and working people end up having to force their way in. Now, of course, once that happens, these other parties have to now try to pick up working class votes. And so like the big challenge of electoral democracy, of political or party democracy rather, is for socialists, we have a certain program, we have a certain idea of how we want to transform society and the world. And socialists have traditionally said that, you know, we want to universalize the interests of the working class. The working class is the only class that doesn't, you know, make their life off of exploiting someone else. So we, you know, universal values where their interests are key or priority. And the problem is that historically, it's been extremely difficult to have a political party just of the working class and then win democratic elections. Mm-hmm. Now, some of that has to do with the actual class composition historically of how many people historically are working class versus, you know, obviously we know who the capitalists are, we know who the landlords are, but there's other people who are not, you know, that are not quite, there's been this weird category that we kind of have called the middle class. And it's given a lot of Marxists and a lot of socialists, a lot of grief to try to figure out who these people are. Not because we're really into like topography or something, but it's mostly because like, we want to be able to know when the political question is put in front of you, which side are you going to be on? Mm-hmm. Part of the problem is that middle-class people typically historically are going to end up siding with capital against working-class people. But that's historically contingent. It depends on where. And there's reasons why, for instance, the Nordic countries end up succeeding so much greater in creating social democracy than other parts of Europe or the US. But I'm digressing to the mm-hmm. Matt's question. I do think the first thing that's worth noting is just the challenges that working-class parties face, which is, again, this... Can you be a workers' party in a democracy and then win in order to then govern and transform society into the way that you want it to be? And again, that's proven fairly difficult. And there's some debate over, you know, to what extent were, for instance, the German or the Swedish SPD truly a class party, truly like exclusively a working party, or were they more what we now can call something more of a people's party, a little bit of a debate, but I think it's not debatable that they were far more class focused on the working class, even if they maybe there was still appeals to a larger coalition at points. But the problem is once you get to this kind of this mid-century post World War II, really, it begins in the 60s and the tail end of the 60s into the 70s, which maps onto what Mayer's numbers show. You get this massive crisis, this kind of the first major crisis post-World War II, post kind of this new order whereby there's far greater state involvement in the economy counter business cyclical measures and things like that, you know, active labor market policy, you know, employment programs, the fact that the state is trying to help with effective demand, all these things, whatever. If you don't know what I'm talking about, it doesn't matter. Whatever. The point being that you get this crisis. And at the same time, I think you also get with the crisis, it's a confluence of a few things. And again, I think it just speaks to how, you know, Mm-hmm. In when you're looking at it in this long view, there is this capitalism is fairly tumultuous. And so on the one hand, the thing, one of the things I mentioned when I was talking about this last week, for Jacobin, is the fact that you get this rise of the middle class of, salaried white collar workers that end up becoming certainly not a majority, not a plurality, but a larger chunk of the electorate of the population. Mm-hmm. That happens at the same time as this economic crisis. And part of that economic crisis is the fact that, the left doesn't really have good answers for it immediately. Some of that has to do with globalization and kind of the fact that capital now has greater mobility globally, whereas the working class, of course, if you're a working person, it's a lot harder to get up and move and follow wherever capital's going. And in fact, capital likes the fact that it can now put you in competition with someone else in another mm-hmm. part of the world, because competition is international and global, even if, you know, a lot of these political contestations up until that point were more national, that you were dealing with, there was internationalism among working class people, but you had, effectively national political questions and political fights, and that changes. And I think the rise of Europe and, not the rise of the EU, rather, the pre-EU. EU is not it's not formally called the EU until the early 90s, but mm-hmm. what's becoming the EU, the European economic, basically trading, trade networks and rules that are being set up between these countries, that ends up becoming actually a pretty big question among social democratic people and voters, over, you know, what is our relationship with Europe? And I think the problem is that in the face of economic crisis, in the face of what's called stagflation, of inflation, prices going up, unemployment also going up, the state trying to maintain what it can of this arrangement and increasing spending, which then the bondholders, the capitalists that are now, you know, going to have to pay a bigger price, like, you know, what's going on? This is not okay. And you do get this larger assault. It's one of these kind of magic moments in capitalism where the capitalists overcome their differences and decide that we're going to unify. Because typically, like, typical capitalism is that capitalists are literally at war with one another because yeah. they're competitors. So there's this unification. They are able to actually, I know I'm speaking a lot, but there's a good quote I could read that, mm-hmm. I think illustrates this, that, James Hartfield wrote this a few years ago. And he says, to defeat the working class challenge of the 70s, the elite tore up the old institutions that bound the masses to the state. Class conflict was institutionalized under the old system, which not only contained working class opposition, but also helped the ruling class to formulate a common outlook. Which started as an offensive against working class solidarity in the 80s, undermined the institutions that bound society together. Not just trade unions and socialist parties were undermined, but so too were right-wing political parties and their traditional support bases among churches and farmers groups. Middle-class professional groups lost their privileged position. It's this confluence of globalization, of economic crisis, of capital responding, of the state responding to the crisis, capital responding to the state, that ultimately leads to, effectively, you know, this assault, the story that we all know fairly well, I think, of the assault on labor and the labor movement. And when you destroy labor movements, when you destroy, unions, you end up destroying democracy, as it turns out, that, working class people have since then steadily declined from political involvement. And it's not quite clear just yet if working people will actually get back into politics. This ended up being kind of the big test of left populism in recent years of mm-hmm. Of can you in fact re-energize working class people through a left political program? And I want to say it's mixed results, but it's mostly negative results. So.
Yeah, just wanted to comment domestically on that, because I think I'm with you.
Say it again
on Bernie, like for instance, like the Bernie, like how would you comment on Bernie on that Because I think that was the hope, like he would turn out a whole bunch of more people, right. And more people did turn out, but they were like suburban and not necessarily like Bernie people. I mean, although some were. I mean, he was successful, but like you said, you know.
I just want to note one thing on that before Kale goes. It is worth noting I agree with probably where this is going in this kind of criticism and analysis of Bernie, but I always do like to make the point that you got to remember the primary system in the United States as a way to sort of gauge like people's, I don't know, votes is really difficult, especially in a lot of places where it's extremely hard to vote in a primary, let alone to vote in the first place. I don't know. It's just something that always has to be noted, that like the very specific aspect of the Democratic Party primary also does play a role in this too.
Yeah.
I think that's true. I think the institutions make this any kind of positive transformation of working class people being re-politically engaged. I do think the institutions limit those possibilities, but I don't think they're absolute limits. I do think, you know, there's been similar kinds of working class mobilizations have happened historically under far more repressive situations. And so it's in some ways the question might be like, can you re-energize working people kind of in the hollowed out carcass of social democracy that we're not living, neoliberalism is neo, not because we're living in pre working class, mobilization, pre labor party, political systems. It's neo insofar as, all the history exists. And in fact, the history of working class parties rising and then falling, and we're living not, you know, tabula rasa, you know, like what would it be like if we could all have political rights and mm-hmm. you know, better things in life? It's, oh, we tried all these things in the past and they failed. And so that, and part of the problem is that like the parties that actively pushed for these working class political agendas in the past, are effectively turned into the collaborators of the implementation of austerity, of labor market reform, of pension cuts, of social security cuts, of welfare reform. Now, obviously, the Democratic Party was never a left party. It was never a workers' party. Mm-hmm. What I just said is more applicable to the European context, where parties like the German SPD ended up becoming basically another business party, about 20 years ago. A much longer slide into that. It wasn't all of a sudden, but that they were the ones that were leading austerity and again, you know, the cuts to Social Security back in like 2004, before Angela Merkel and the German the Conservative Party took over. But nevertheless, in the U.S., you know, obviously, like the Democrats have been the party of working people to the extent that we have had one, beginning with the New Deal coalition, and that was thoroughly torn apart. And I think that's where I think a lot of working people. The problem hasn't been that working people have left the Democrats and moved to the Republicans. What we've seen from the data is that overwhelmingly working people have left the Democrats to just not be in a political party. And to the question about Bernie, you know, is Bernie successful or not? I mean, obviously the answer is no, because he lost, but you know, to what extent, how severe is that loss or that no? And I think Iowa, Nevada, and California are maybe our best hope for an alternative measure or alternative strategy, rather, that, you know, it's not that people in Iowa are that different from people in South Carolina or in Virginia or in Texas or wherever else. Like, there's differences, of course, obviously, some of them cultural, some of them, you know, institutional, of like the relationship between the electorate and the party in South Carolina is a little bit different than it is in Iowa. Some of that legacy is a very kind of twisted legacy with civil rights. The fact that like the Black political class that takes over in South Carolina are attached to civil rights and therefore have like a far greater kind of political affinity with the population, and yet they end up becoming some of the most right-wing Democrats in the country. regardless, I do think like the lesson of the Bernie campaign is that if you're going to revitalize some kind of left political project in neoliberalism, in kind of our populist moment or era, or whatever you want to call it, it's going to take down and dirty, hard, door-to-door mass politics. That the reason why he won those states is not because he had the best message or the best ads, because he had the best message and the best ads in Texas and in Virginia, wherever else. It was that myself and others, a lot of people, tens of thousands of people went to these states or were in these states and knocked on doors. And there was a lot of conversations where you would talk to someone and say, hey, takes 20 minutes on Tuesday to go caucus for Bernie. And because it sounds like you could really use Medicare for all and a wage raise and all these things. And they would say, yeah, I like it all. Sounds good. It's not going to happen. I'm not going to do it. And it's like, just 20 minutes. And it's like, no, I'm not doing 20 minutes in a caucus. That's the level of demobilization that the country is at broadly, I think, among working people. And that the fact that Bernie got these victories was just a sheer force organizing.
Right. I mean, that makes a whole bunch of sense. I mean, it's sort of like that's anecdotally, that's how I hear anybody influence these giant elections in any kind of small way. Is I have a buddy who was in Iowa for the Obama 08 campaign as well, right? And like the extent you can do anything, there's that, and use this as opportunities, I guess, to spread the message.
Yeah.
I would just say, like, you know, I'm back home now and like in the kind of like work class neighborhood I grew up in, and I talk to people all the time, talk to my neighbors, talk to old friends and stuff. And, you know, it's always interesting to hear talking about, for example, Bernie or these things. And there's typically a lot of positivity. It's like, oh yeah, I liked him. It's like, well, did you vote? It's like, oh no. And like, you know, there's some of it that's like, oh, it's difficult, but there's also the kind of feeling of like getting kicked again when you're down. Right. And this is the kind of, you know, I call it like political depression that like, you know, a lot of working class people feel in this country, which is like, you know, things just aren't going to get better, right? And it's like, why go and sort of make a fool of yourself by standing in line here to vote for a while to, you know, have something that you might feel is like, you know, pre-rigged or anything like that. And it's like, those are the things, like those are certainly causes, I think, of a lot of demobilization, but the demobilization also comes from just crushing defeats. And I think that's one thing too, that's worth noting, that like, you know, I mean, we gotta be peppy and like sell a vision of the future that like mobilizes folks, but it's like, there's a lot more like work too than just like, I don't know, like the best pep speech that we could ever imagine, right? You have to start showing people that we can win, and that we have organization, that like you are like your neighbor, you know, you're in a community. And I, you know, those are tough and sometimes sort of abstract things to know what to do with, but like that really is like why not only did they attack unions in the 70s, but like there's this destruction of a lot of, I don't know, culture. And it takes a few decades for all of that to seep in, but like the culture of working class people too has been sort of replaced with this very individualistic sense. All these kind of things are, you know, are outgrowths of this smashing of working class power as it was starting to articulate itself across you know, Western Europe and the United States.
Yeah, totally. And I think the part of it, you know, it helps explain why, you know, when you do get a Bernie candidate, or you do get left populist parties in Europe, you get Syriza, Podemos, the Corbyn Labour Party, Die Linke, that working class people don't just automatically look at that and go like, oh yeah, of course, that's what I want. You know, like they could, I mean, I'm sure a lot of them, like, the thing is, like, if you went by opinion polling in the United States, if you could actualize opinion polling on healthcare and on wages and on job security and on college and on maternity leave and on childcare, we would be in 1970 Sweden. But we don't have that. And it's not because workers are stupid or they don't know what's in their own interest. Workers know what's in their interests as much as anyone else does, as much as you or I or anyone else. I think like if you're going to do politics, you have to assume that the people you're working with or that you're engaging with, or that you're reaching out to, that you're door knocking, or, you know, just your political subjects are just as rational, just as aware of themselves and their world as you are, more or less. They might not have read the same books as you, but like, you know, they have different experiences in life. Sure, fine, that's all true. But the fact that they vote differently than you does not mean that, you know, a working class person votes, you know, for the Republicans or something, doesn't mean that they want austerity necessarily. It doesn't mean that they don't know what's in their own interest. It just means that politics is highly mediated. There's a lot of misinformation, and they don't have good options, viable options. Because to David's point, what he was just saying, I mean, I think like the best lessons you could take are from labor organizing, because in those situations, it's higher stakes in an immediate sense of, well, if this fails, I might not have income, and I have to feed myself and my family and pay rent. And, you know, it's going to be higher stakes than like, well, you know, I hope I get the right political outcome in this election or something. And the way that organizers are successful when they are successful in labor organizing is through building a culture of solidarity, of trust, that the people that are organizing together understand we're in this together, and what we're fighting for is possible because we trust each other. And that's difficult to expand, into, electoral politics, because electoral politics happens in the millions. Whereas, organizing a shop floor it's most likely this, you're not going to be organizing a million. You're not going to be organizing a thousand, most times, like it's going to be smaller shop floors. But the point is that, to make those connections and to make people, especially again, in kind of the rotting carcass of social democracy that we're living in right now, you have to convince them that your political project is viable, that it's not just a bill of goods, that it's not pie in the sky. And I think that has been a problem for these left populist parties that have come about, whether it be Bernie or Corbyn's Labour or Die Linke, where the activists in the group are saying, we have this full idea of what a better society looks like, and we want this thing, and it has, in this regard, in this aspect of life, it's going to be like this, in this aspect of life, it's going to be like this. And it ends up becoming way too much of a utopia. And politics is all about priorities. And so you have to, in an election cycle, you have to be able to frame the election around key specific policies that you say, like, this is what we're fighting over. This is an election over healthcare. This is an election over jobs. And so this is, I think it's, and again, it's not, it's just, it's a factor not of, people have bad intentions or are stupid. Like now I'm talking about the party, the activists or the party members or the people creating these things within the left. It's downstream of populism that, in order to play the game of electoral politics, when this is, Peter Mayer puts it in a really nice way, where he says that there's a problem both of supply and demand, that on the supply side of the party, they have shifted their actual political programs and their messaging. And they're no longer offering a class focused working class political project, a project to the benefit of working people. And it's coupled on the other side with a demand problem of there just isn't the same electorate that there was 60, 70 years ago. That doesn't mean that there's not a working class. It means that there's not an actively engaged working class.
So we got a question actually from JB here. We don't normally do super chats, but this is relevant. What is the working class in 2021? How do you define it, Kale? It ain't St. Petersburg in January of 1917. What is the shop floor now?
Right. It's definitely not St. Petersburg in 1917. Obviously it depends a little bit on which countries we're talking about, but presuming it's, the United States or just maybe like Western Europe broadly. It used to be, there was debates on the left over, who's in the working class, that some definitions were very narrow of just like, it's manual industrial workers. Like that's the working class. It's like these blue collar people that show up to a factory. Now, that was never just the working class. What they're highlighting is the fact that if you are an industrial worker, you have a lot of your position in society means a couple things. It means that you have a lot of room to create disruption, both in your workshop or your workflow, rather, and society at large, because you're creating, sorry to be jargony, but like you're making you, if you're working in a factory, you're probably making like, you know, big things that end up going into other, I said I was going to use jargon and then just start saying big means of production. It's like, you know, it's like every capitalist needs means of production to operate. If you're in a, you know, in a factory that's producing heavy industrial goods that, you know, other capitalists need, and then ball you bearings. Shut down. Yeah. Sorry.
I just said ball bearings, for instance.
Yeah. Well, that, or, you know, just like machines, broadly. Right. I mean,
fair enough. Yeah.
But the point being that like the industrial working class matters, but obviously that, I think, both sociologically, but politically, it's far too narrow of a definition. And it just, again, the question, the real question that we're asking, the reason why we give a shit about class analysis at all as socialists, unless you're some academic type, which you shouldn't be. Like if you are a socialist, your question is, which side are you on when there's a political question at hand? If it's something like healthcare, if the question is Medicare for all, which side are you on? Now, that's not going to, which side you're on doesn't determine which class you're in, but knowing who's in which class matters. So to actually answer the question of who's in the working class, it is, of course, the case that there has been a good deal of reshifting of the economy. This is the part I left out of the story a moment earlier, that there has been deindustrialization. Far more people are in the service sector than they once were before. But if you are, you know, someone who has to show up to work every day and labor under a boss that you have to sell your ability to work to someone else, and in exchange they give you income so that you can then buy what you need because you're dependent on the market, then you're a worker. If you, you know, if you don't boss anyone else around and you have a boss, and if you don't show up to work tomorrow, you would be fired, then you're probably a worker. Now, obviously, the middle class is a little bit trickier, but the idea of the middle class is just that it's people that have overlapping, contradictory class interests, where they both are being exploited by a boss in the sense that they most likely, it depends. There's like professionals typically fall into this, managers fall into this. I would say small business owners are middle class as well, insofar as they don't own significant parts of the means of production society. Like they're typically also kind of at the mercy of large capitalists. CEOs are definitely capitalists, even though they're technically managers, but most managers are middle class. It just means that, you know, you are exploited. You do sell your effort to work, your effort to labor to someone else. It just, as a middle-class person, you're not subjected to the worst, you know, vagaries of the labor market that you, because you have credentials, you know, you maybe have a leg up against, someone who doesn't, in getting a better paying job with greater security. A middle-class person probably also has a career track where they understand, okay, I'm working somewhere that eventually down the line, I actually might end up having, a better salary, and a different position. And that's something that's pretty uniquely middle-class, that most working class jobs are not going to have that kind of mobility. So most working class people, you know, you show up to work every day, you work under the thumb of a boss. He tells you where to stand, what to do, how long you're doing what you're doing, when and if you get a bathroom break. And if it feels like I'm avoiding the question a little bit, it's in part because we don't actually have good sociological data on who exactly is the working class in America. I think this remains something that should be done as like actual research of like mapping out who working people are. But we do know these qualities of what it means to be a working person, the fact that far more people are service sector. And that we also know, again, the posts, this part of the reason why, like, why is it where we started, you know, why is it that like these downwardly mobile middle class people are interested in socialism? There has been this further proletarianization of middle class people, in the sense that even though living standards are pretty different between a working person and a middle-class person. The working conditions have actually, I think, converged more and more, that a middle-class person is going to be subjected to greater surveillance and oversight and greater, you know, quota demands. And then you get all these think pieces and all these, you know, all these middle-class people like, oh, I miss work back, you know, like what working used to sound like back like 20, 30 years ago. Why is it that, you know, we're getting screwed so much? It's like, yeah, it's because you're being subjected to far more working class, working conditions, but right. you're still not, you still have a greater living standard. And that's why working people fucking hate these people, because they whine and complain about this in the media. And they're like, bitch, I've been doing this since the 70s. Where the fuck have you been?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Those new, like, like those qualitative things that everybody
it's like
knows.
It's like new rich, right? They're new poor, right? There's a whole, there's a whole sunny, it's always sunny Philadelphia episode about this. Like, oh, these people are new poor after the financial crisis.
I haven't seen that one.
Oh, it's a good one. Yeah. Cause they're complaining. Sorry, not to derail, but they're complaining cause all these people are showing up and camping outside the bar and it's pissing off Max character. And he's like, these guys are new poor. They don't know how to be poor with dignity like my family. Right. No, but I mean, but one thing though, like, you know, that's all a joke, but like, one thing that I do just want to note from Kale's answer, is that, you know, that's something very different from like culture in general. And like a lot of the ways that like most people, when you talk about working class or all these other classes, they are going to think about a kind of cultural, you know, analysis on top of it. I mean, I think about some of the folks that I went to school with who would be considered like, who'd be a perfect person for like a CNN, you know, reporter to come to Texas and be like, oh, let's talk to the working class community. And they'd be like the richest motherfucker, like at the school, right? Because they had like the brand new truck. They had a real nice, they had the money to buy all of the kind of like cultural trappings that some people consider to be, you know, what a working class Southern person, how they would wear, how they would, what they would wear, how they would talk, et cetera. Right. And I think it's really important that we sort of be wary of that on our side too, because it can really muddy your analysis if you're thinking about these things solely through culture.
Yeah. I think that's right.
Well, Kale, we really appreciate this conversation. I mean, we'll have to do something again soon. We went on a bit longer than we typically do, but I'm really happy. There's a lot that we were able to get to. And, you know, everyone watching, we solved the problem of how to build socialism in America. We solved the problem of how to build a political party.
Your marching orders.
No, like,
if I could say one last thing actually on that, I think this is maybe like the way to round this up. Because I do, like I was saying to Matt's question earlier, I do think Bernie provided us a way out of this, which is that I do think that if politics for most people, you know, was limited to a small, you know, maybe you spend a couple hours a week, maybe not even a week, maybe a couple hours a month on some political contribution, I think that would vastly change the political culture in America. Mm-hmm. Because we've seen that, you know, in both, I mean, we got a better representative, we have bigger sample size in 2016 because we finished out the primaries under like, you know, not like 2020 where COVID interrupted it. And it would have been interesting to have seen how that played out between Bernie and Biden and, you know, how long that fight would have gone on. Biden probably still wins, but regardless, it would have been interesting to see how many people in America end up voting for Bernie Sanders. You know, DSA has 100,000 members. Some of the other, you know, organizations in this country have a couple tens of thousands, maybe at best, explicitly left organizations. You know, Jacobin has something like 80,000 subscribers, you know, to the magazine. You know, I don't know what Labor Notes numbers are, but it's probably fairly small. It's a few thousand. Those are our institutions on the left. You know, we were collectively probably not cracking 200,000 people as far as like active participation. And yet Bernie Sanders gets millions of people to vote for him. Mm-hmm. And so I do think what Bernie did, and he did this, I think, even better in 2016 than he did in 2020. And that's not knocking Sanders at all. You know, I think it's just, it's a different election. It's different yeah. conditions. You end up making different choices. But when you pose a really, a part of it was like just being up against Hillary Clinton. When you get to pose a really clear political contrast and a political question, and you say, you know, again, which side are you on? Mm-hmm. I think that's how you're going to end up, you know, and pushing people on that, working with people on that, and, you know, showing up and, you know, being an active part in their life, showing up to their particular fights. You know, when a union's on strike, the left should absolutely be, you know, doing what it can to support that. When workers are trying to form a union, they should, the left should be doing what it can to help support that. When there's, you know, a social outcry over some horrible injustice, you know, the left should do its part to try to be a participant in that. Not reactionary, just tailing every single thing. Obviously, mm-hmm. you know, you make these decisions when they come up, and, you know, but the point being that, like, the more that the left is embedded within working class people's lives, and that our political project is not this airy utopian thing that's exclusive to like grad students, it's actually presently addressing their immediate needs. And then you get something like a Bernie that poses this question of which side are you on? I do think that, you know, people will respond. You can mm-hmm. reactivate people. And again, just, we have to go back and look at Iowa, Nevada, and California and see exactly how we won there. Mm-hmm. I think it was this.
Yeah. It's something that takes a lot of work, and that work might take a lot of time, but it's also something that has the potential to happen quickly as well. Right. And I think that that's like, that's the, you know, the thing is like the timeline is not always clear, but yeah, the, where we're trying to go makes a lot more sense. Thanks very much, Kale, for hanging out with us this evening, man. Love to do it again sometime soon.
As always, hopefully I'll pick something that I have less to say about.
No, this is perfect.
See you, Kale.
All right. See you guys. Bye.
All right, folks. David, do you need a break, or should we keep on chugging?
We can keep on going, man. I'm all inspired now. That was a fun conversation.
You know what's funny? Like, one like cause for optimism is just realizing how much the right is, and corporations are mobilizing against the fear. That, like, that's what the best line in Marx is, the specter is haunting, mm-hmm. right? Because that they really are like constantly afraid that we might actually do what we want to do.
Yeah. Well, I thought you were going another direction. It's very funny to think that the right's not having conversations like this, right? Like right winger, like political activists are not like having long conversations about like what the makeup of the working class is.
Navel gazing. Yeah, no, exactly.
I mean, that might be the luxury that comes with winning and having the world made for you. But
yeah, no, it's look at this college student that doesn't know when the Declaration of Independence was signed.
That's true. There you go. So there's another segment that I want to add to the docket, but let's do this first one that I already talked to you about first. I sent something to you in the chat to pull up later. But I want to talk about Stephen Donziger and this case here. We hadn't done anything on this yet, not because we didn't think that it was important. In fact, we thought that it was so important and so egregious and so clear that, you know, we didn't need to cover it on this show just because we, you know, it's a one day a week show and we have to pick our stories, you know, for maximum impact. But this is just something that should make your blood boil. This story is so unbelievable. It cuts at everything from corporate power, but to the complete erosion of our democracy in unfortunately very clear ways.
And law.
I've just been amazed, Matt. I mean, we'll talk for people who aren't familiar. We'll give you all the breakdown of what this is, why he matters, what this fight's about. But I was just saying to Matt before we went live today, trying to like seeing how the lack of coverage in like mainstream media of this has just been infuriating, because yeah. this is just like, if you're any kind of a journalist, this is the story of a lifetime to cover, right? Big corporation coming after a human rights lawyer for defending indigenous folks from, you know, just wanton destruction of the environment, right? It's just, I don't know. This seems like something that's a no-brainer. I'm not saying that people aren't covering it. You can definitely find it on the back page of the newspaper. But this is not the big story of the past couple of weeks, and it really should be.
No, Will Menaker of Chapo has put more effort yes. toward this story than probably all major cable TV networks combined, all personnel.
And right? Will is a much better interviewer and yeah. than most of those folks in the first place. But yeah, I mean, this is the thing, is it sort of has been left to
it's a story that media. Corporate media sort of designed not to tell. Like, this is the dystopia that they are basically handmaidens for.
Well, it's one of those stories that when they do cover it too, you know, not to turn this whole thing into a media critique, but right. like, it is such an example of like the press release press that we have in this country, because there's a lot of like both sidesism around this case that really, really there is just it's clear cut, right? This is a corporation, extremely evil corporation, using all the power that they have, including utilizing and pressuring state actors to act on their behalf against someone. But let's just give a quick breakdown and we could talk about some of the more egregious things here. For people who aren't familiar with Stephen Donziger, you know, he's a lawyer, human rights lawyer, who worked on a decades-long case to bring to light the human rights abuses against indigenous people in Ecuador by Texaco, which is now owned by Chevron. And if that was just what he did, that would be an absolutely noble effort. But Stephen did something that typically doesn't happen. He won. And he won a $9.5 billion judgment against Chevron for the destruction and the purposeful pollution of the Amazon rainforest in Ecuador. And what has he gotten in as a result of this? A huge target on his back. And in this case, it is the state, it is the legal system that has been called in to do the hit against him. So he wins this massive judgment, takes decades, but it was a judgment that was ruled in Ecuador, right? And because there weren't enough assets held in Ecuador to sort of, you know, pay these things out, they had to be held. Trial had to be held in the United States, Argentina, and other countries, basically to try to get these assets from Chevron, right, to implement the judgment against them. And this is where corporations like Chevron have a lot more ability to kind of put their thumb on the scale of justice. Do you have something, Matt?
No, I'm looking at the Washington Post coverage of this stuff, and just like this headline from 2016, just like the neutral, like, Chevron claims another round in endless jungle fight. Like,
yeah. Oh, Lord. Is that really?
That's their headline.
I mean, Jesus Christ. Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. And if you're not, if you don't have people sort of pointing to this and saying, like, you need to pay attention to this, you know, it just seems like another kind of procedural fight. What happened here, and what we're talking about right now, specifically about this case, because we could do a whole episode, honestly, about this case and all the things that were exposed and all the things that were done. But specifically, what's happening right now is Stephen Donziger was held for over 2 years, I believe, on house arrest in pretrial on a contempt of court charge, right? A misdemeanor, which is extremely, extremely, extremely rare for anyone to be held pretrial for something of this nature. And people should understand what it's for. It's because a judge ruled that he should hand over his laptop and other personal information to Chevron and Chevron's lawyers so that they could use it in the court case, right, as a part of discovery, I believe, right? And obviously, a massive corporation like Chevron that wants to make an example of someone like Stephen Donziger, he refused to turn it over because, one, it wasn't lawful in the first place, and two, they were obviously going to try to use this for a whole host of other things, not to do with the case itself, right?
And also that is chilling on any lawyer who might want to go up against them in the future.
Yes. No. To have to hand over your laptop to your opponent is absolutely insane on any terms, but especially on these terms, right?
Yeah.
And like that's the one thing to really note here is that this is certainly about getting revenge against Stephen Donziger, but it's also about making a threat that, like, they not only have a lot of power and influence, but they have their guys on the inside to try to push results in the way that they would like to see them.
And you come at us, and it's going to be messy for you, and you're going to get exposed.
Yes. And like, and we'll get to some of those folks in a second, but just to speed everyone up, if you're not familiar, he's in there for 2 years, house arrest, right? Ankle bracelet, house arrest. You know what I mean? Just like an insult, to somebody who not only should be free to walk around, but should be celebrated in the streets, right?
Parade.
he's held for 2 years under a pretrial house arrest. And he was just sentenced, to 6 months in prison. And typically in a situation, which is a travesty on its own, but on top of all of that, typically after somebody had already served so much time under house arrest, the judge would just chalk it up to time served, right? But they didn't. And the judge here, Judge Laurietta Preska, and we'll get into her and all these other folks in a moment, literally said that Stephen Donziger like needs to be hit by the proverbial 2x4, right? This is somebody who literally had it out for him. Let's add not only the absurdity of the of her ruling here, right, and of her sentencing. Stephen Donziger was denied a trial by jury. So this in this situation, this judge who very clearly has a vendetta against him, right, was also the jury and the sentencer, which is just absurd, right? It's ridiculous that even is allowed to happen in this country. It
would have been ridiculous 200 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, so he's now sentenced to 6 months, and he's going to appeal, and we're going to put up some calls to action and things of that nature. Actually, Matt, if you're able to,
I got done free Donziger.
There's a video of him actually speaking that would be helpful on the website that I sent to you.
On Free Donziger, it looks down unless it's up for you, but unfortunately, freedonziger.org.
Oh yeah, the website is down. Yeah, I wonder what's going on with that.
There's still links to the defense fund if you want to donate and stuff, but it looks like.
Wow, with this web, I mean, that's just sort of, this is happening to us live. I don't know if this is just, you know, a kind of technical difficulty or not. We'll find out more later. But I mean, that was a very well populated website. So that, you know, this wasn't a kind of rinky dink operation. Mm. That's actually quite, quite frightening. All right. I would have loved to have gotten his words there, but let me see. I can show
this
you.
This is what we got now. Yeah, this.
It's coming. Yeah, it's site currently down.
But you can still donate if you need.
There's still the link to the donate fund, so you can go onto the website freedonziger.com and you can find ways to donate, and hopefully it'll be repopulated soon. But let's just talk about the lack of justice in this case, right? Because it's just much like the sentencing is ridiculous, right? All these other things are ridiculous, but like when you start to look into this case, like the more you learn, the more ridiculous it gets, right? It's one of those moments where like it's bad enough on the outset, but it gets worse. This has been a long fight that he has had with Chevron. And the first character in this story is a guy named Judge Lewis A. Kaplan, right? Who is the person who ended up picking Preska to be the judge against Stephen Donziger, right? But Kaplan was overseeing the case of, you know, wrongdoing. Basically, so what happens is after the $9.5 billion judgment, it gets brought into the United States. And then Chevron sues Stephen Donziger for the case itself. Right. And they start to sue him, alleging that there was wrongdoing in the case. And it is a whole long drawn out trial. Again, we should just probably do a whole episode breaking down all the dynamics. But just what you should know here is that while all of this is going on, Donziger gets this ruling that he's supposed to turn over all of these personal documents, which he then appeals. But this person, Judge Lewis A. Kaplan, is a former tobacco lobbyist and somebody who has substantial personal holdings in Chevron. So much so that in the past, I believe he has also recused himself from cases relating to Chevron, but not in this one.
I would say that's an admission of a significant amount of, if you ever do that, a significant amount of conflict there.
See, no, I mean, absolutely. And So, you know, so this shouldn't have even gotten as far as it did there. But again, too, if you go back and you read the pieces in the New York Times from, you know, from those years back, there's really no mention of any of that. It's just like, oh, well, look how great, how much this star has fallen. Look how much this hero of the environmentalist movement, look how much this hero of the human rights, legal professions movement has fallen, right? He is now being, you know, embarrassed in an American court, right? So then Kaplan handpicks Judge Loretta Preska, who is this judge in the Southern District of New York, who, as I mentioned before, denied him jury trial, denied public access to the trial, ruled against him time and time again. I mean, just kind of basic procedural stuff just made it hell for them to defend Stephen Donziger in court. And let me share this picture with y'all right here, because this is pretty amazing. Like, truly showed that she had contempt for him and these entire proceedings. While I'm on, this is from earlier this year, while I'm on trial facing prison, Loretta Preska, my judge, jury, and fact finder, has been casually reading the newspaper from the bench during witness testimony. It feels like it was over before it began. And here's, you know, they don't allow cameras in there, but here is the artist's rendering of her reading a newspaper during the court proceedings. I mean, that's a really is as clear as it gets. But it also should be noted that she is a member of the right-wing Federalist Society.
Oh,
yeah.
Those guys. Yeah.
And you have to understand, too, that, like, you know, I'm not a lawyer. So I'm trying my best to, you know, to express to folks like how unusual this case is, right? It needs to be noted that when this original suit is brought up against Donziger, essentially the government gave prosecutorial power to a law firm that worked for Chevron. Right. So the prosecution in this case has been a private law firm. Again, that works or has worked in the past for Chevron. This is why this case is just so important. And it's important because it's a travesty.
It's a kangaroo court.
It's a kangaroo court. And look, we all know the problems with the legal system and the democracy in this country. But if you,
this is even
have
different
any hope for a better future, and you're sitting here watching our court system, right, which is supposed to belong to the people, right, our democracy, which is supposed to belong to the people, being utilized to service the interests of corporations, not just in its rulings, but actually within its functions itself. This is an extremely chilling and worrying course. This has been a horrifying saga.
It's using the courts to shake down somebody who uses the courts to hold the most powerful companies in the world accountable. And there's nothing really more to say about it than that.
There are actually just two quick things to say about it. The United Nations has recognized that this case is a travesty, and they have called not only for this case to be thrown out, for Stephen Donziger to be freed, but for the United States government to pay him reparations for the horrors that he has gone through. And the last thing I just have to note is, like, let's not forget that while all of this is ongoing, the people who are affected by Texaco and now by extension Chevron's greed and callousness to human life and the life of this planet, those people are still there in the wake of all of this, while, you know, American right-wing factions and corporate factions are doing everything that they can to intimidate a human rights lawyer. This is something that we can't sleep on, and we need to be pointing people to as much as we can.
Yeah, man.
Well, there's one last thing I want to get to, Matt, because I don't think you've seen this. This was a quick segment, but it's so good. And one of these moments when you do realize, just like in that case, how much our system is just dominated by corporate interests, or at least interests of the elite. I'm just going to share this tweet with you. I don't know how much you've been following what's been going on here in Texas with the border wall. Greg Abbott has been making a big deal about basically securing private funding so that the state of Texas can build its own border wall now that Biden has sort of slowed down the Trump administration's policies. But I don't know if you've seen this. So basically, when he's first soliciting donations there's just like a trickle, nothing close to what would actually be needed to build the wall, right? As you would expect, because who the fuck wants to pay for that other than complete lunatics?
It's funny how demobilized everyone kind of is right now, except like anti-vax people. But anyway,
yeah, that's true. Except one group of people are highly motivated, billionaires.
Okay.
And this is a breaking story from Texas Tribune today, just right before we went on, that I want to share. Texas has raised $54 million in private donations for its donor wall, right? But almost all of it came from this one billionaire.
What?
And Matt, you might recognize the name here, the last name at least, Timothy Mellon, who is the grandson of banking tycoon Andrew Mellon, is responsible for 98% of the donations to the Texas Border Wall Fund.
That's the Mellon of the Carnegie Mellon Mellons. Is that correct, I would assume?
Andrew Mellon, the banker. I mean, Carnegie Mellon, I don't know about the relation.
I assume they intermarried, well, I guess, but maybe what? I just assume that was a banker intermarriage, but maybe.
No, I mean, they're both, I know, from Pittsburgh, so I'm sure there's a relation there. But I mean, this is just old school American money right now being used to funnel and protect.
What a fucking dumbass.
He's got plenty of money, and he's been donating to a lot of Republican candidates over the past few years.
But like,
and
he's a big
booster of Donald Trump. But beyond that, I'm sorry not to be a little nationalist here in Texas, but like, this is one of those things that gets really amazing, right? Where there is some guy who made all of his money basically in New York, right? Talking, you know, the legacy, right? This is just old school American New York banking money, you know, moves over to Wyoming and is now trying to dictate and fund shit here in Texas. He has, sorry, Wyoming, right? I said Wyoming.
Right.
He has no connections to the state. He has no connections to the people, but he is dead set on them trying to build this wall. And I just made a note. It's like, I wonder how many people who are like truly affected. And if you talk to people who are on the border, specifically people who are threatened by like eminent domain being used to like, you know, seize land from folks, people worried about the environmental consequences of this, people worried about communities just being needlessly disrupted. I wonder how they would feel if they knew that the people behind it, the people who are funding this project now, it's a person, and just happens to be an old school silver spoon, New York banking, great grandson.
So, I mean, really has no excuse to be this degenerate in like planning. Cause like, look, I understand a billionaire funneling funds into like tax deductible, like organizations that rile people up for anti-border sentiment to eventually make the government pay for the wall. Dude, just paying for the wall yourself. Like, you're high on your own supply. Mm-hmm. Like, that, you're missing some steps that are like, a billionaire is supposed to understand synergies. Like, you're, I don't know. And so, no excuse, because you're, like, again, born into this shit. You should know better. But I mean, it just seems ridiculous to me. Spending your own money to put a pointless fucking fence into the
wall. Well, it's super insane from the rich guy who's doing it, but it's also interesting for people here because of the way that it's been sort of leaked, right? The way that it's been presented to most folks has been like, look, all of these people are donating to make this project happen because people really, really want it.
It's a popular thing.
Yeah. And that's been the real scandal of it is that, this is not something that all these people are throwing their hard earned money at. It's like something that one person is throwing, some money that was, stolen over 100 years ago. Right.
That's really great. So yeah, they ruined the whole like propaganda value of it, which is the real, I guess, reason they're doing that. Not so much the dumb fence, but look at everyone's still mobilizing. Actually, that's politics 2021 for you.
And it also is a reminder that the history of this country is very present today. But yeah, that was fun. We got a lot of stuff coming up in the post game. We have Matt has a Facebook breakdown. He has more rapping tech boys.
We're going to go into those tech boys. We're going to talk about them moving to New Zealand a little bit. There's a good article on them. Also, we're going to be talking about Dave Rubin on the Facebook whistleblower, which I think kind of shows, again, this is very interesting, where you have like people kind of people on the right speak in a similar language to the left, but then it veers off at a certain point into like silliness. And there's something sweet about Dave, like playing him after Crowder, who is just a nasty little freak.
Yeah,
like I mean, Dave's nasty in his own way, but like there's a lot. It's a gentler kind of nastiness than just the rancidness of Crowder. And I also want to get into. I want to bash a philosopher. I'm trying to remember his name right now. It's the positive and negative liberty guy. David, who is it?
Berlin.
Isaiah Berlin. Yeah. Seems like a big herb. Like this, and it's really being used in a way that, you know, all this stuff we've talked about it a little bit on the show before about how these folks are saying Marx was the originator of this oppressor and oppressed sort of schema. And this apparently comes from a renowned philosopher, Isaiah Berlin, I guess, according to like a Cambridge University Press book. Anyway, we're going to get into all this. I'm going to bash philosophy. I'm going to get a little bit Neil deGrasse Tyson and say, plus, this is why philosophy is bullshit.
We might even have some Alex Jones talking about great philosophers, too. I don't know if you've seen this most recent clip. We can do a live react to that as well.
Dude, yeah, omnibus philosophy segment.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, so patreon.com/leftreckoning, folks. We'll see you probably around 10, 9 Central.
Sounds good.
Patrons. See you, folks.